Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, and joining alongside me today is Nolan. Back to another solo episode, and we'll be kind of going through some of the more, I guess, like topical topics. That sounds terrible, but you get it. And we'll be looking at some of the things that are going on in the space. Of course, we're going to talk about some AI. Like, why wouldn't we? It's probably one of the most transformational things happening in our space. And I'm not alone here. Luckily for me, I've got my producer Manny here with me once again.
Hey, everybody. First time on camera. Feels different, but, you know, I'm glad to be on this side of the Publisher Lab this time.
They finally get to put a name to the, or a face to the name. Manny's kind of appeared on a couple shows just briefly, and he gives me a brief reprieve at times whenever I'm, you know, talking for a long time and, you know, just need to catch my breath. So we decided to get him a camera. So now you know, if you watch on YouTube, what producer Manny looks like. So you may hear him from time to time throughout the podcast as I kind of spit my ideas around and toss them around. You guys know that they're, you know, pretty honest takes most of the time. So sometimes I like to get outside opinions because I'm a bit jaded by the space. But I feel like that's a sentiment that's shared among probably our audience and probably among publishers everywhere, because there's just so many parties in this space that have their own self-interests, I suppose. And I think that that's something that over time you sort of see how that works out, and you realize that you've got to kind of, somebody's got to watch your back, and that's got to be you a lot of times. So especially in independent publishing. So today we're going to talk a little bit about generative AI and some of the things that are going on there as far as copyright. We're going to talk about seeing AI as a tool, not a replacement, and what those applications might look like. And then we're going to be talking a little bit more about some of the things that are going on in Google's trial, and maybe a couple things on the in-between there as well. So we'll go ahead and get started with the first topic that we've got up today is generative AI content explodes. This is the headline. So do we need more watermarking for something like this? So for those that are unfamiliar, which I doubt most of our audience would be, but watermarking is a process of traditionally using some kind of visual or electronic, just some kind of mark that is on a piece of content or an image or really any kind of media that sort of identifies it as the authentic version of. So like, you know, a painting or an image, you know, anybody that's used like Getty Images or Shutterstock, they have the, you know, Shutterstock kind of like clear text written over it. That's a watermark. So as we produce content, whether this is video or, you know, written content even, there have been more and more sophisticated ways that you can sort of watermark your content so that you can identify if somebody has stolen it, or, you know, you can look at something like YouTube is a great model for the way that video has been sort of easily identified whenever there's audio or something, maybe even in the video itself, that is not free and fair use that somebody is using their video. So, you know, maybe I go, you know, clip out something from the Barbie movie and put it online. Didn't get the express consent from whatever movie studio put out Barbie. Manny, do you know who put out the Barbie movie? What, like, movie studio it was?
I haven't seen it yet, but if I had to take a quick guess, I think it was Universal.
It's probably a good guess.
Universal or Warner Brothers. I know it was one of those two.
Yeah, that sounds right. I know it wasn't Disney. But nevertheless, you know, if I was to use, you know, clips from that particular movie on a YouTube video, it would probably get taken down relatively quickly. And the reason being is that, you know, they're able to identify that content in a couple of ways. Number one is a lot of times video, especially video that's uploaded to the internet now, will have a visual pixel added to it. So that visual pixel will be so small that you won't really even see it in the video, but it does allow you, theoretically, you know, like you can extrapolate out to maybe a court case or something like that, you'd be able to identify that content as yours, because you could say, look, there's this tiny, tiny pixel here. You can't see it, but it's there and we can measure it and you can see it in the video codec or the encoding. And so that's my video. So whenever it's used, there's ways of video platforms using that to, you know, take down content that's maybe copyrighted, rather quickly. And then the same thing for audio, the same little technologies that exist on a cell phone that run, you know, an app like Shazam, where you're sitting at a bar or a restaurant or out in public and you hear a song and you're like, ah, oh, I love that song. What is it? You know, you can use the Shazam app to hold your phone up and it'll tell you what musical recording artist and what song that is. So what's interesting about, you know, this AI content explodes and the need for watermarking is that I sort of feel like we're applying something that's already not good enough to something that's going to be already exponentially more complicated as it relates to this topic. And I think we talked about this a little bit on the last podcast, but this idea that, you know, AI generated content, let's just take away that this idea that human content and AI content are actually any different for a moment. And I know there's people probably ready to like jump up and be like, but just, let's just assume that robots and humans, same content, either one can make it, it's fine, nobody cares. So with that in mind, you have this bigger question, I think, and this is what's going on in the Hollywood writer's strike, I think. And I think you're going to see this in a lot of other things, because I heard Post Malone recently talking about this. He was talking about how the AI can actually generate songs of his that are good. He's like, I like them. He's like, you know, it's made a few where I'm like, hey, I really like that. Should I, you know, play that song? And it's such an interesting, you know, like, are you going to steal now from the machine something that, like, you know, you don't even have to produce the content itself, whether it's a video or music or something that's written. It's like you could actually have AI produce it. And then, you know, if you want to validate it, you could take it. But I think it begs the bigger question, and this is something that he didn't bring up, but it's what we talked about on the last show. And it is that the AI can produce that music that Post Malone himself says, I like that. It sounds like me. It sounds like a song I would make. It's good. I actually really like it. The only reason it can make it is because it has his source material as a source of sort of information and data. And so, yeah, you can actually, so this is where it becomes like a really complicated case, because if AI is using pieces of content or information that is taken from lots and lots of places over time and then generating something new, that is a violation of most of our existing copyright laws. However, you can think about the things like prompts or additive data. So if I take a original piece of written content, let's say, and I copy paste it and I ask ChatGPT to rewrite it, but I say, look, I want to make it much more visual. So I want you to shorten it. And then I want you to add these charts, these citations. I also have, you know, unique knowledge on this piece right here. So can you maybe add a little bit there, add a little bit over here? You know, if you're writing a university paper, they're going to still call that plagiarism, even if it's unidentifiable. But it's this sort of like collaborative effort where it's, you're taking something that already exists and you're building on top of it something new. But the bigger question is, you know, can you produce that without the original piece? And the answer is, well, you can't, but could you? And in some cases, yes, in some cases, no. And I think that's the real question that we're posed with here, because today we do have some mechanisms that you can allow this. You can license, you know, likenesses, you can license all kinds of different technologies and tools and different things like that. But what happens whenever the thing is not something that's so big and easy? It's really easy for, Manny, who's somebody that might license their likeness to something?
First person I think of would be Snoop Dogg. I can definitely see him doing something like that. I mean, I was talking about it with Jack earlier today. The whole business of voice actors is now going to be completely different, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming that voice actors, like, if they're prominent enough, like a Nelson Mandela or a Snoop Dogg or even like a Seth Rogen. Yeah,
real similar. They both probably, like, going competing for the same types of voice acting work, I'd bet.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, those are very different roles. But like someone who has a very distinct voice, kind of like a Seth Rogen, I could see them just licensing out their AI voice as opposed to actually having to go, you know, into a studio and record audio for several hours at a time. So I think it's just going to change a whole bunch of things.
But yeah, you know, what's really interesting, you bring it up now, and I think it kind of speaks exactly to your point about, you know, licensing your likeness. These are big time celebrities and stuff like that are doing this, you know, with AI and the things that it can generate. It's not going to just be big time celebrities. It's every single person that's ever produced something, you know, a creative work. And that's kind of the point. But it's interesting on the voice thing, because in particular, I know on a lot of the voice apps and stuff, they've taken Morgan Freeman off as like a voice clone celebrity from like the, like, you know, little apps on the iOS store. And it's because it's like the most voice cloned and most sort of like iterative voice that people want to use when they're just doing like, you know, voice changing things and stuff like that. And you think about, you know, somebody that's known for their voice, you know, it's definitely Morgan Freeman. And if you don't need Morgan Freeman for Morgan Freeman's voice, I mean, obviously he could license it, et cetera. But what about whenever you're using, you know, a combination of voices, somebody listening to the show matches up a Tyler Manny voice? I don't know why you would, but maybe you do that. You know, like Manny, I don't know if you're going to get paid for that. I doubt I do.
And I mean, you also have to take into consideration that putting these watermarks is not a foolproof solution. I work with design and video a lot, and like you can always think of a way to bypass that. Like what you mentioned, if you put a pixel on a video, or if you put a pixel on a image or graphic on a website, what's stopping someone from them just screenshotting it, or, you know, finding a way to screen capture it and then uploading it again, and then now that video doesn't have a pixel on it because it wasn't technically created with AI, it was recorded of an AI.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, like, that's, you know, back to my original point on this, I think that kind of, like, highlights what I think is the core issue here, where it's, this is already not a good strategy because it's very circumventable, if that's, I don't know if circumventable is a word, but you guys get what it means, and it means you can work around it, so, as Manny described, like, you can basically, with one or two simple steps that not too many people wouldn't be able to figure out on their own, can bypass most of these. So it's already a system that doesn't work for today's issues. So I don't imagine that it's going to be a great one for tomorrow's. Kind of moving on in alongside kind of, I guess, sort of the same lines. So one of the things that we've talked about a lot recently is on this show in particular is the application of AI. And I think in the last show we talked a little bit more about, you know, I have a very positive outlook, I think, on AI for the future. And everybody has their own ideas and opinions, and I'll save you many of mine, which I've talked about some on the show. But I do think that there's an element of, right now, humans are doing many of the things that AI can and should do. And I say should because humans are being sort of like, whether it's through work or just even through your devices themselves, you're being trained to be more like a machine. You're being trained to do the computing, right? Like, you think about all the different things that are like automated, where you spend time, you know, hooking things together, or you get an email, you send an email, you know, you're responding to things, you know, like you're clicking on things and opening windows. Those things are computations, you're computing. And so I do think that there's an element of AI that can be, that will replace a lot of things that humans do that we shouldn't maybe hold on to with as much nostalgia or as much, I guess, like fear in some cases as maybe we might think. But nevertheless, I think how publishers can look at using AI today is there was this article from Adweek, and it talked about how publishers using generative AI to streamline and improve revenue operations. So that's a good example of where you would want to use something like AI and machine learning, something where you have a lot of variables, especially math, where it's like, it's a very objective sort of like task or, you know, sort of thing that you want it to do. So if you're trying to optimize, you know, like ad placements, or you're trying to optimize what is the right balance between product, you know, offers to an audience and ads and maybe subscription offerings and different things like that. It's the best for that because realistically, you're going to have a bunch of audiences that perform differently in all those things. So you're going to want to test them, not A/B test. You're going to want to basically have like multivariate testing where you're testing all the different variables and different combinations. And then you're going to want to actually like serve each audience the optimal, because the problem with A/B testing, which is pretty much the extent to which a human can perform like good testing today, you can use AI and do more sophisticated testing today, but A/B testing is about as good as a human can handle, because after that it just gets so complex. It's just the speed at which you can implement the results of a test as well. But the problem with an A/B test, even when you're able to conduct it properly, is that you're left with this like A and B group, where it's like if most of an audience preferred A and then the others preferred B, like which do you give them? You give them the A group, right? Well, the problem is like then it's like, well, the B people just like don't matter, and you make, you know, in this case, you'd make less money from the B group. So multivariate testing is something that AI is particularly good at. But that being said, you know, some publishers, including Politico, Newsweek, and Bustle Group, have started using generative AI to improve back end commercial processes, leading to increased margins, higher win rates, they claim. And I think that this is probably true. I do question whether or not big, you know, sort of like long legacy publishers are great at measuring revenue. In my experience, a lot of times they don't calculate things properly. So I'll give you a good example of this, because I'm sure some of our audience are interested, but because I actually talked to a reporter from Adweek yesterday about this exact topic. But if you're if you work at, let's say, I don't know, I'll make something up, we'll call it Shoes Week. If you work at Shoes Week and you're a big news publisher and you are, you know, working on all the different ways you want to optimize your revenue, and you want to sell direct deals to advertisers, and you've got some sales guys doing that, and then you've got this whole staff of people that are, you know, data scientists that are optimizing everything and looking at all the different ways you can make revenue, and you've got a creative team that's coming up with promotions and things like that to try to sell more products that you maybe work on with brands. The problem with this is that all those things I just mentioned, when they talk about like, well, our revenue increased, we made so much more money off of our product sales or our ads or whatever, our EPMV, RPM, CPMs, they're all up. This is great. Problem with that is that, you know, when you're an independent publisher, like, you know, maybe 1 to 10 person operation running some sites, you know, that kind of movement in terms of your revenue and that sort of progress and improvement is significant. I mean, like, you can't imagine. It's, you know, in some cases it's 4 to 5x, and that's game changing. However, the problem is that, you know, all those people that are doing those jobs at a big brand publisher, those costs are significant. So then when you actually add in that overhead to the increase in revenue, and then cases where I've seen it and done the math with publishers, they lose significant amounts of money. Like, it's not even close. They don't make money from that. And so there's a lot of reasons why you might still put in this effort, and over time, maybe the overhead costs like decline once you sort of like get things in place. But I do think it's a little bit of a red herring to say like this is something that AI can, you know, that AI can do this and that it'll bring this to everybody. Because one of the things that I think is at the core of this is some of these things are relationship based. So yes, you know, you could imagine a world in which AI can do everything, right? So it can be a sales guy, it can build a relationship, blah, blah, blah. But I actually think that where we're going to find that AI is probably not really something that's a valuable tool. And this kind of gets to the point of what we've been talking about, is when do you use it as a tool? And a good example of when you use it as a tool is math. Bad example is building relationships. I think I've mentioned before, you know, both Facebook Messenger, Google. I know that there's a lot of other platforms where it's like if somebody messages me before I can even type out maybe a full word, it's giving me an entire response. And most times it's pretty good. I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I want to say. So accept. But Manny, if you and I start texting back and forth and I send you an original message and then you get an auto response, you don't have to type back to me. And then I type something and then I realize the AI's got my right response. If you and I go 8 messages deep, but I only sent 1 and the rest were just AI generated, you know, how much of a relationship have you and I built, you know?
I don't think very much. I think in that case, it would be very much the me talking to an AI version of you, right? There was actually a South Park episode that recently came out that was discussing this, where Stan was having relationship problems with his girlfriend. And then one of his buddies was like, dude, just have ChatGPT write everything out for you. And then after like a certain amount of time of them in a relationship, the girl felt very connected to him.
Yep.
And he had no idea why.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't in the relationship. That was all AI. And I think that's a good testament to like AI should not be building your relationships. It should just make your workflow faster.
I think so. One of the things is, and so my very first startup company, we were based in positive psychology and did a lot of research. The guy that I started the business with, his name was Louis Ray, and he was one of the first people to get a degree in positive psychology from the University of Penn, from a gentleman by the name of Martin Seligman, who is kind of the founder of positive psychology. And one of the things that I used to always stuck with me about, there was a lot of different things that I learned working there about just human psychology, but really positive things about like, you know, how do you generate something like happiness? A lot of psychology is focused on what's wrong with you. Positive psychology focuses on what's right with you. How do you make humans thrive? And one of the things that we used to always say is that, you know, the things that bring you pleasure, the things that are, you know, almost the most instantly gratifying, those things are good, but they usually don't provide any sort of like lasting substance. So we would say it's like, you know, spending your money on something that's like transient, you know, something that's gone. Like gambling even would be a bad example. I'm trying to think of something, you know, like food, where it's like you could buy an ice cream cone and eat it and taste good, but that money's gone and that you probably don't feel super great about eating an ice cream cone a couple hours later. However, you could, you know, spend your money and your time, you know, investing in healthy food. And when you're eating that healthy food, it's not going to taste great. Maybe not as good as ice cream cone, for example. But over time, later on, whenever you're not having to go to the doctor, you're healthy, you know, your clothes fit well and you feel like you're looking good because you're nice and strong and fit. Then you do feel good. So you've built value in these things and that took time and energy to build. And the same thing is true with relationships. So if you can bring this all the way back to our, you know, publisher ad sales example, where all of a sudden you've got publishers that are trying to sell ads to advertisers and maybe AI communicates back and forth, boop, 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 boop. Well, the value that actually throughout time the advertising industry has operated on is the old like take Jimmy out to lunch type thing, you know? And because of that, you end up with this, you know, like relationship built, and you can sell some actually direct ads on your website to a big brand because one of the sales guys there built a good relationship. But what happens whenever it's just AI? It's back and forth. It becomes a very transactional sort of thing. So if you can think of a situation where AI can even complete multiple steps, as long as there's like a goal, something for it to achieve, like there's parameters, it's good. But in relationships, like, I don't know. I mean, there'd definitely be people that argue with me on this, but I don't think that in relationships, it's necessarily something that you want to be building goals or view it as something that where there's something to be achieved. A relationship is sort of more like, it's like a river, a stream. It sort of like cuts its own path and flows where it goes. And yeah, nature is its own thing. So I sort of see relationships a little bit more in the nature category where I generally think AI should probably stay out of. What do you think, Manny?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think if you're using AI to respond to people for emails, I mean, at least at the very least, just edit the email, reread it. I think that AI is going to be very useful as a tool to kind of speed up the way you're working and make whatever you're working on that much better. But it shouldn't, you know, talk to your friends.
Yeah, probably not. I don't want my friends talking to my AI, messing it all up. But I do think that, you know, listening to this as a publisher, it sounds like, you know, if I want to be specific, it's like AI should be doing so many things that you're probably doing today. I mean, yesterday as a team here in the office, we We started using Dream Studio just to generate some artwork that you might see here on this very podcast. And it was to really just sort of like get everybody using some new tools and stuff, because I do think that a certain amount of your time every day and probably each week, you should be trying to find and explore a lot of the new tools that are out there. And just playing with those tools, you know, we get to talk about and point out like a lot of different things that are out there that, I mean, realistically have shown up in the last 6 months that are very interesting. You know, you've got these online places like Hugging Faces where you can literally download data sets, models, tools, software, prompts, all this kind of stuff that are essentially open source that you can then use and bring in. So if somebody else has trained something specifically to do different things that you might want done. But you've got things like, I think it's called Clip Drop and Dream Studio that allow you to make amazing sort of images and graphics of every shape, size, and form, edit a lot of different things. I mean, I think Clip Drop has a Photoshop extension as well. And that's something that I think, you know, it's pretty good. I mean, removing backgrounds is something we've been able to do for a while, but adding in another background based on a prompt, I mean, that's incredible. And I think that as we kind of move over time, you're going to start to find that, you know, the content that you can imagine is going to be something that's so much greater than the content that you can make. And today, I think even now I find myself, whenever I'm making a piece of content or something, I restrict myself sort of to the parameters of what I've always done. So I'm using AI to do the things that I did before, maybe just faster or differently. But we should probably be rethinking about how we even make the content to begin with, because, you know, if you were constrained because you were the human making the content or the human that it was having to tell a writer what to do, et cetera, just take that all out of it and just imagine unlimited resources and what you would want to make. And you could work towards that, because I promise you there are tools that can be daisy chained together and a mechanism that will allow you to do that. So I do think that that should be the goal, and that should be how, you know, AI's approach to the tool.
Hey there. My name is Connor Porter, and I'm a technical support specialist here at Azoic. I wanted to take a few quick seconds to tell you about our tool, Leap. No one likes a slow browsing experience, and are you paying for countless plugins that promise improved site speed and performance, but only make things worse? Leap is a tool that has everything from optimization features to diagnostics, so sites can pass Core Web Vitals. And the best part about it? It's absolutely free with an Azoic account. Simplify site speed and cut unwanted plugin cost, and check out Leap today.
On a different topic, Google's antitrust trial. So we'll kind of finish with this today. So Google, as we talked about in the last couple episodes, they've had antitrust allegations and an antitrust suit brought against them for anti-competitiveness, specifically in the advertising space. So, for those that aren't familiar, antitrust is generally sort of broadly defined as using a dominance in one area or vertical industry to create dominance in another. So Google, in particular, in advertising, where you host both the buy side and sell side, so basically people that are wanting to buy like space for ads, and then people that are willing to sell space for ads, and then the entire sort of like, they call it the ad exchange, but you can kind of think of it as like the roadways in between. So this is sort of like, if Walmart owned, that's a bad example. I'm the master of bad examples, but either way, you just imagine it's like you guys all experience it every day. Advertiser comes in, says, I want to buy something. Google says, stop right there. What would you like to buy? And they say some ads. They go, okay, great. We allow you to buy ads on many, many places. We actually have this whole exchange where everybody's allowed to bid whatever they want for whatever is for sale. And they go, okay, that sounds good. And they say, well, come on in. And then they sit down and then they get ready to start bidding. And then Google says, what would you like to bid? And they go, well, I thought I was going to get to bid freely, go and figure out like what everybody's wanting to price. And they're like, we'll tell them. Don't worry about it. Like, just tell us what you want to bid. And they're like, all right, well, I want to bid on this and I want that much. And they go, okay, cool. And then they go, I'll be right back. And then they go over and they talk to the seller and that same thing takes place. And so you've got these buyers and sellers and all these intermediaries but there's only one party doing the communicating. And so that's a lot of trust, and there's a strong financial interest to do things in a way that incentivize things for you. And, you know, in this trial, I think one of the things that came up that Manny and I were talking about before this was that I think they'd ruled that Google's results in search specifically Google had not done anything to that hurt competitors. Was that right, Manny?
So it was a partial victory. So it showed that they didn't hurt competitors such as Yelp or Expedia. However, they were concerned from the mobile market on how they deliver stuff in default browsers like Apple Safari and Android devices. So it was a partial win, but they're still under a lot of investigation.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably one of the easiest to win is that, you know, Google reviews are not, you know, something that is harming Yelp reviews or something like that. Because I think, it is interesting, though, because I do wonder, is it a chicken or the egg thing, right? So, like, you could pick something like the reviews and say, well, Yelp reviews aren't really harmed that badly by the search results. So Google didn't really, they didn't intentionally manipulate things to, you know, favor themselves. But you got to kind of wonder a little bit if Yelp reviews are even a thing, if it's not for Google reviews. Like, maybe that's a user preference thing where the users are actually working around Google's dominance. And I think that you could say that about just about everything where, you know, Google could say, well, look, we haven't done anything to try to potentially harm competitors. But in some regards, it's like it's a matter of sort of like boxing out everyone else from even trying. So like how many search engines are there out there? How many websites, how many different business ideas don't exist because you essentially are competing with Google, which I don't know how many people are starting search engines right now. I'd try to talk you out of it for a lot of reasons. But primarily being that, you know, it was always considered almost impossible to compete with them there. And if you're trying to compete in a, you know, like if you were to create a new travel, online travel booking website or something like that, I mean, you've got your fair share of large public companies to compete with, but then also Google Flights and things like that. I can't think of a worse business to try to start. And for that reason, it's, you know, could you argue that that's anti-competitive? I don't know. Manny, what do you think?
I mean, I definitely think it's kind of like a bullying situation, right? Like the bigger guy on the playground is definitely telling the smaller guy, like, hey, you can't wear, you know, whatever shirt or something. It kind of reminds me of when Facebook took over Reels or kind of like hurt Snapchat or it's trying to hurt TikTok, or even the more recent case where Threads came out of the blue and is like, hey, we're going to try to take over Twitter because Twitter isn't Twitter anymore.
Yeah. And I think that the decision making behind many of these things are harmful to a lot of the potential like new entries. But I find that most of the behavior that I think is done intentionally is very much aimed at 1 to 3 other companies. So you can think about like something like Speed, which is, you know, Google trying to find a way to like cut Apple off at the pass and, you know, fight so that, you know, people use the open web and web browsers where Google's very dominant. Versus something like an app-based web experience. And then you've got, you know, Apple kind of like doing the same thing to Facebook a little bit where and Google, where they're trying to eliminate third-party cookies and, you know, user tracking and privacy because they can cut them off there where their businesses rely largely on audience targeting and advertising and Apple's doesn't. So they can kind of disrupt them in that regard. And, you know, it's really consumers and publishers and, you know, everyone in between that's kind of harmed by those things. But the good news is that there's never been a time in history where these large entities haven't been disrupted. The time scale might, you know, be significant, but they all do. And I think we're definitely in an era right now where you can imagine that happening. Realistically, to all of them, even Apple, who I've said recently a couple times and gotten kind of strange looks from people, but I could very much see a scenario in which Apple, the first $3 trillion company, you know, they become far, far less relevant over the next decade. And I wouldn't necessarily make that prediction, but I would say I don't think that they're off limits in terms of they're not going to be affected by everything. But that being said, not the happiest note to end on. Well, actually, you know what it kind of is, because I doubt there's anybody on this podcast that's like, no, I don't want that. I hope the big tech like lasts forever. And if you are listening to this podcast and that's how you feel, I'm surprised you're still a listener, because we haven't been necessarily kind all the time to big tech, but that doesn't mean that they're not providing value, and there's a lot of really interesting and innovative things that they've done over time. So not to be too down on them and to try to be as fair as possible. You guys know me. But I want to thank everybody for listening or watching to another episode of the Publisher Lab. You can find us on publisherlab.org. Leave us questions, comments. You know, those things are great. Being able to get direct feedback from our audience, it really guides a lot of our decision making. We look at data and analytics like anyone should, and you would imagine we would. But to me, you know, the feedback directly from the audience is so much more valuable, because it gives insight into what people actually like versus just how they behave. So I would appreciate that. If there's something that you'd like to hear more about or for me to dive into, if you want Manny to wear like more silly hats or something like that, you leave that in there and it's done. Manny will wear silly hats every podcast.
That's going to be fun to explain to finance why I ordered so many silly hats.
I'll explain for you. Don't worry. I got your back. I'll be like, look, these are necessary for audience growth.
Nikes and silly hats.
Absolutely. Well, we want to thank everybody for joining us on another episode of the Publisher Lab.